Hi, everybody. In this session, I'd like to focus on production and distribution of addictive substances in the American experience. I already made the point last time that from the very beginnings of European colonization of North America, the production of distilled spirits, rum, a little bit later whiskey, were really important parts of what made it possible economically for European colonies to survive in North America. And that has always been part of our experience. We have always been exporters of addictive substances. In fact, the addictive substances that we primarily export are those that do the most harm, cause the most death, and do the most harm, namely tobacco and alcohol. I don't want to go back over that material about the North Atlantic slave trade, but the whole purpose of that trade was to facilitate the production of rum from sugarcane, and a good deal of the rum produced went back to trade for more slaves in Africa. So it's a pretty, the production and sales of addictive substances was hardwired in that period, I think, into the DNA of America. It's hard for us to see because it's so much a part of our experience. I thought I'd say a little bit about production and distribution in America during the Revolutionary War period. We're familiar with, I think, the narrative of revolutionary movements, particularly during the colonial period, people revolting against the mother country have enormous challenges that they face. They don't have the same military capabilities. They don't have all the things that you need in order to be able to revolt against a colonial power. And so very commonly what you do is you find some way to generate a lot of cash fast. Selling addictive substances is one of the ways to do that. And so we, and the FARC in Colombia wants to overturn the government of Colombia. What do? They finance it with the sales of cocaine. What did Chiang Kai-shek do when he was sort of pushed out of southern China into northern Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia? Well, he ran, sold protection to the opium dealers in that area to help finance his efforts to overthrow the Chinese communist government. What did the Vietnamese do when they were fighting against the French? They later on against the Americans. They used proceeds from drug sales to finance some of their revolutionary efforts. And that's sort of narrative of how you revolt against an oppressive government that you now experience as a foreign government matches the American experience very well. A couple of things often mentioned as precipitating causes for the American Revolution, they're certainly not the only reasons, but the sugar and molasses tax of 1764 was passed by the British Parliament. This imposed a tax on it could actually reduce the level of taxation on importation of molasses. The British colonies in North America imported a lot of molasses from the Caribbean area, And they had a choice of whether they purchased their molasses. It could be the French colonies in the Caribbean, or it could be the British colonies. If they purchase it from the French colonies, they're importing, according to the British Parliament, they were importing foreign molasses, and that needed to be taxed. And in 1764, they extended an already existing tax on importation, but it had not been enforced, and they started to enforce that tax, thus increasing the cost of producing rum. And this was perceived as an existential threat by the American rum producers. A year later, the British Parliament passed the stamp tax, which was a broad attempt to generate funds to support the it's expensive to have colonies; they need to pay for themselves. Would be the logic and. So this was a tax on documents, deeds and contracts, but it also included tax on liquor licenses. So you now, if you wanted to sell alcohol, you had to buy a liquor license. And the reaction to that was pretty pronounced. It seems to me, from a big distance, quite disproportionate, but it was part of the growing ferment that led to the American Revolution. Now, during the American Revolution, like any other anti-colonial war, the Continental Congress is looking at their books and saying, we don't have anything here. We've got to find some source of funding for this or we're in real trouble. And typically, like most post-colonial wars, the Americans went to the enemy of their enemy, which was the French. And they sent Benjamin Franklin to France. Benjamin Franklin was already a known quantity there. He was kind of a star. And he did all kinds of tasks there, including arranging for shipping military goods and so on. But he also had to raise a lot of money. He had to raise his own expenses because the Continental Congress didn't have any way to pay him. So he had to raise his own support and come up with enough money to make the American army a viable opponent to the British forces in North America. And so you're negotiating with the French to get very large loans, and they say, well, what's the collateral for this loan? And what does America have that can serve as collateral? They have tobacco futures. And that's what they used to cut a deal with the French. That in exchange for you give us money now, we give you the result of our tobacco harvest for, I don't know the details of the arrangement, but it was the production of tobacco that made it possible for the French to help finance the American Revolution. Also in this same time period, the first real threat to the cohesion of the new fragile American democracy was the Whiskey Rebellion in 1794. The Whiskey Rebellion was also related to the Revolutionary War. There was a tax on whiskey production that was needed to help pay off France. The U.S., not many people remember this, but the U.S. almost came to war with France after the Revolution because of defaulting on loans and a number of other things. But they put a tax on whiskey production to help pay off the Revolutionary War debt and to finance the new government. They made a significant tactical mistake in this legislation in that they charged small-time producers of whiskey at a rate higher than they charged large producers of whiskey. Small distilleries were mostly out in the Ohio River Valley. The big producers were out on the East Coast. So you had this enormous outrage out in the western edge of things against this unfair level of taxation. Washington eventually sent 30,000 American troops out to western Pennsylvania to help quell this riot. Most of the stuff I've read suggests that it was in fact quelled without a whole lot of violence. But just the fact that he had to send 30,000 troops out there at this time in history is pretty remarkable. So again, it goes to the fact that messing with or putting constraints on alcohol production was perceived as a kind of existential threat in early America. Because producing and selling addictive substances helped us survive. Now, we have, I'm going to skip through a lot of history here, but we are still in the business of producing and exporting addictive substances. This graph shows production, I mean, exports of whiskey and other distilled spirits between 2009 and 2019, so 10 years. During that 10 years, exports went up quite steadily. From about $1 billion worth of sales at the beginning of that decade to $1.5 billion. So a 50% increase in exports during that time. Again, if you think of whiskey and other distilled spirits just as another product that you can buy in a grocery store, well, maybe this is good export policy. But if you remember that this is the cause of enormous amounts of death and disability, a public health problem on the planet as a whole, a public health problem of the first order. Now, export of cigarettes during this period have not gone so well for American producers. This is from 1960 through 95, and exports of tobacco products from the U.S. has gone steadily down through that entire period. Complicated reasons for this, I think, largely is the fact that production of tobacco is still a very labor-intensive process, and so it's going to gravitate to places with lower labor costs. And so that's what's happened. You have a lot of Eastern European countries who are active participants in the international trade in tobacco now. You have just lots of different places to get tobacco. And this is American share of total exported tobacco. I think the fact that we're selling less is a good thing for us. But of course, if you own shares in different tobacco companies, who also, knowing this trend was going to take place, have globalized and invested in production capabilities in lower labor cost parts of the world. Now, there is another issue that I don't have time to really go in depth to, but this has to do with the U.S.'s role not in the production, the direct production or direct sales of addictive substances, but it goes to the ways in which we have often unintentionally facilitated the production and sale of addictive products. And here's one hint at that. This is the production of opium in Laos prior to and following the Vietnam War. So Laos has been producing opium for centuries, if not much more than that. But this is, I think it's in tons. But you can see the general picture. U.S. involvement early on was after the French sort of cut and ran, was starting in the early 1950s. I think they were doing, the kinds of things the CIA does covertly, But not too long after that, production of opium starts to go up. Now, maybe what they did was infrastructure projects, you know, building roads out into the hinterland so that the government military could have more ready access to some of these areas where they might need to go. And that access also provided, if they're going into opium production areas, an easier route to market for opium rather than taking, you know, donkey caravans down through Thailand. You could take trucks down to market towns in the south. First, troops arrived in Vietnam. First large-scale deployment of Marines, thousands, was 1965. Production of opium rose even faster. The war ended in 75, at which point production of opium in Laos plummeted. Now, so there's a correlation between... It's a correlation. It doesn't necessarily mean causation, but there's a correlation between, clearly, I think, between levels of production of opium in Laos and American presence, American military presence in Vietnam. Now, there's lots of plausible explanations for this. It could be that the war itself created large ungovernable areas, parts of the country where it was just a chaos in terms of governance. And that made it possible for people to increase opium production because there were no police on the beat. That could be part of the reason. I also suggested that building increased infrastructure, roads and bridges and so on, which were intended to facilitate transport of the military more quickly to different parts of the country, might have also facilitated, you know, unintentionally perhaps, but might have facilitated transport of opium to market. And I suppose the third thing is that there was a substantial market emerging among military troops in Southeast Asia. So you have new people to sell to, and that increased demand leads to increased production. Now, I'm not suggesting that anybody on the U.S. side intended to increase opium production, but our rule, it does seem certainly plausible that our military intervention in Southeast Asia had that unintended consequence. And there are certainly people who have stated that much more strongly than I'm stating it today. The whole notion is unfortunately reinforced by looking, as troubling as it is reinforced by looking at opium poppy cultivation in Afghanistan. This is from 94 to 2018. Notice that in 2001, the anomaly of it just almost stopped production entirely. This is when the Taliban were in charge of Afghanistan. But throughout the following 20 years, opium production in Afghanistan has gone up steadily. And again, this could be the chaos effect of war. There's no police on the beat about this. It could be the increased infrastructure and facilitation of transport. It could be that you have that the American forces of necessity had to find local allies, and many of their local allies were also involved in opium production, And so you didn't want to destroy your ally by destroying their capability of producing opium. And so you're kind of between a rock and a hard place about there. How much do you compromise your ability to achieve military objectives in order to achieve an objective that may not feel to military professionals like an appropriate goal for the U.S. military, that is, reducing the production of opium. So, a complicated matter, but again, I think it's pretty clear that whether intentional or unintentional, we facilitated the production of opium both in Southeast Asia and in Afghanistan, and don't really have clean hands here. This one quote about that, a former ranking DEA official who requested anonymity explained how pragmatism and self-interest often entangle insurgencies in the illegal drug trade. First, insurgents will reject drugs for ideological reasons, as when the Taliban considered the use of opium haram. Later, they will offer protection to unaffiliated drug lords, reasoning that the profits contribute to the greater good. That is, we're not raising opium, we're not selling opium, we're selling protection for convoys. That's not so bad. And finally, insurgents will get involved directly because they'll see the amount of money to be made there, and they realize for their insurgency to be successful, they need larger amounts of cash. Now, I suppose the other sort of set of circumstances that fit into this category of facilitating production in some way, even unintentionally, has to do with the Contras in Nicaragua. They were an insurgency group, American-backed and sponsored, although mostly covertly. And here is a quote from a former CIA agent familiar with those events. Here's what he says. Once you set up a covert operation to supply arms and money, it's very difficult to separate it from the kind of people who are involved in other forms of trade, and especially drugs. There is a limited number of planes, pilots, and landing strips. By developing a system for supply of the Contras, the U.S. built a road for drug supply into the U.S. So we don't have clean hands even, we certainly don't have clean hands with respect to export of addictive substances, because we grow addictive, we produce addictive substances, and we sell them in the international marketplace. But we don't even really always have clean hands when it comes to people out there who produce addictive substances that winds up here. We have facilitated that in some cases. I'm not suggesting that there's anything simple about that. It's pretty complex, but American policy in this area clearly put military and political objectives ahead of reducing the amount of drugs available for sale in the United States. I think that's pretty obvious myself. A couple bottom lines. The production and distribution of addictive substances has played and continues to play a very significant role in American culture, economically, socially, and politically. We are deep in the thick of this, and we do not have clean hands. Secondly, and I think the conclusion with pretty broad significance for us, both in terms of public policy and at other levels, is that the problem is not out there. This problem cannot be solved at the border. The problem is in here. The problem is somehow kind of deeply hardwired into the American culture. We are the source, after all, of the demand side. but you don't seem to be able to control them. And in many cases, we produce drugs that hurt other people and get mad at them for producing drugs that hurt us. Until we can get to the place where we can be honest about the complexities of all that, I think we'll still wind up with drug control policies that miss the point. We've had we've had a war on drug for a long time now that has not resulted in the outcomes that anybody hoped for. We have plenty of drugs, cheaper prices, higher quality. So I think it's time to take stock and say maybe what we're doing needs to be changed somehow, because this just isn't working. All right. I think that's all I'll say about that. Next section I want to talk about the history of consumption of addictive substances in the U.S. I'll look forward to seeing you there, and I'll be happy to talk about any of this stuff in the forum. Thanks a bunch. Bye-bye now.